Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly. This week, I am delighted to present to you Megan Maas, PhD, is an assistant professor in human development and family studies. Her work sits at the intersection of sexual violence prevention and sexual health promotion. Her award-winning research, recognized by the American Psychological Association, focuses on adolescent sexual socialization with an emphasis on the bidirectional role that social media, sexting, and online pornography play in the development of attitudes and behavior related to sexuality and gender. For the last 10 years, she has been invited to talk on this subject for audiences of students, parents, and teachers at universities and organizations across the US. In this interview, Dr. Maas discusses the allure of pornography and its impact on relationships and young people. She talks about gender differences with regard to how pornography is perceived and research that suggests it has become a popular medium for both men and women. She discusses the societal influences that cause many people to associate danger with romance, morality, and ethics in the porn industry, and how best to talk to your children about sexual imagery on the internet. Just before we get into this week's episode, I want to thank everyone who so generously supports this podcast on Patreon. Without your support, we wouldn't be able to keep this podcast independent and free of ads. So thank you. And just a reminder, as a Patreon supporter, not only do you have my eternal gratitude, but also you get some awesome gifts, including 20 to 35% discounts on all supplements we recommend when working with clients, which saves many of our supporters $50 to $100 per month over what they were previously paying on Amazon. So by supporting the podcast, they're actually spending less money each month. In addition to that, you also get access to our office hours, where my scientific director, Megan Hall, answers questions every week. You can submit all your own questions, as well as listen to the replays, covering everything from liver function tests to air filters. We've worked really hard to make sure that the bonuses you get are actually way more valuable than what you pay, whatever level you choose to support us at. So if you'd like to support the podcast and get access to the discounts and office hours, just head over to mbt.link and sign up there. Again, that's mbt.link. Thank you so much. Now let's head over to this week's interview with Megan Maas. Well, Megan, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
Does the weekend mean anything to you anymore?
No, definitely not. No, I have two kids, 4 and 7 year old girls. And yeah, my husband works. We're all working from home and schooling from home and living from home now. So it's all just one big jumble.
And I know professors, they tend to spend their weekends writing grant proposals. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Well, it's good to hear that.
How did you know? Gosh, my dirty secret.
They're all the same. I've met a professor before. Well, it's good to hear you've got skin in this game of sex education. I worry a bit about experts that don't have skin in the game. You know, they have no contact with reality. And so they can say whatever they want and it doesn't matter. They'll never get found out, right?
Right. Oh. But man, it's really oscillated back and forth because I started out as a certified sex educator, like working in the trenches sort of a thing, and then transitioned to academia. And now when I work with community members, it still takes me a while to go, oh, wait, we can't implement the most perfect thing ever and everybody's going to turn out well. And so I do have to sort of still check my ivory tower-ness quite often.
And how did you become interested in developmental psychology and sex education in the first place?
You know, I wish I had a really great story to tell, but it's really been an evolutionary kind of process. It's really evolved over time. I was one of those kids who was allowed to watch TV nonstop. And so film and television really shaped how I see the world and see myself. And so I became really interested in how these sort of fictional and creative stories impact our real lives. And I actually was working in the film industry for a while and was a film major and then realized I don't want to be broke for the rest of my life. I want to make some money. So how can I sort of learn and understand people in a different way? So I was attracted to psychology, you know, because it is the study of human beings, but instead of, you know, researching fictional characters in a creative way, you're researching nonfiction, real life people in a scientific way. And then I became, you know, interested in seeing how media impacts people over time, just sort of from my own experiences. But also as a, you know, as a sex educator and someone who does sex research, particularly for adolescents, we learn through observation. There's lots of, you know, studies that will show that we learn how to be parents and friends and employees through watching others. But the only place you watch people have sex is in pornography, right? We might see, there might be some, you know, alluding to sex in film and movies and that type of thing. And so that's sort of how that piece got integrated into sort of understanding media more broadly. And then I guess I've always been the kind of person who's never been afraid to discuss the elephant in the room. Right. And I've been told that that's a trait that I've had since I was like a child. And so pornography is really the ultimate elephant in the room. And sex, you know, just in general sort of is too.
Why do you think that is? I'm an engineer, and engineers, they like to understand the process before they attempt to intervene. You know, all interesting systems are complex and a full understanding isn't always possible. But where do you think porn came from? It's kind of interesting that it just sort of popped out of nowhere with photography and then it's just become ridiculously popular now.
Sure. Well, we're sexual beings. We want to see naked people and we want to watch people have sex. We want to understand sex and sexuality, as it is the most primal drive that we have, is arguably our drive to reproduce, as well as to eat and sleep and stay safe and that type of thing. So I think a lot of the interest in sex is just not even conscious, right? It is just our innate human nature. But we've always sort of had depictions of, you know, sex since caveman drawing days and art and sculpture and that type of thing. You know, people ask me about the Kama Sutra. And in my human sexuality class, I talk about it, but it's not porn. The Kama Sutra is very much about spirituality and religion. It's just using sex as a way to gain more spiritual enlightenment, which is different than, you know, viewing erotica, which means sex depicted in art, or viewing pornography, which actually the Greek root words mean photograph of a prostitute. So I kind of argue that the distinction is we've always had erotica. We've always wanted to sort of celebrate sex in its various ways and to look at, you know, nudity and watch people have sex. But pornography is really more about, well, photography, and is also a type of commodification of sex, or sex turned into a product. So that's why the industry in and of itself, and understanding, you know, how markets work and supply and demand and that kind of thing, is, you know, distinct when we're discussing pornography than if we were discussing erotica or painting, sculpture, or that type of thing.
One of the things I've spent a lot of time thinking about is the prehistory of human sexuality. I've recently reread a fantastic book called Sex at Dawn by Christopher Ryan. And Chris is a previous podcast guest. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that work, are you?
I'm not, but it sounds fascinating.
Oh my goodness, I'm surprised. Oh yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah, so you might say that the central thesis of the book is that the primary purpose, that is the first and most important thing that sex does in humans, is actually non-reproductive. It's for bonding and social network building. And it's possible that sex went from this thing that everybody did, it was the fun and friendly thing to do, that everybody saw. And gradually, especially with the invention of agriculture, it kind of moved to this, the end of the relationship escalator, you know, like it was the final thing you did in a secure relationship, secure monogamous relationship. And it happened behind closed doors. And so you never would have seen it. And I wonder whether pornography was a very rapid step function change to correct what was always there, right? So the ancestral condition would be you'd see people having sex all the time, and then gradually over the course of a few thousand years, which of course is the blink of an eyelid in evolutionary terms, it went to being something that only happened behind closed doors. And I wonder if that was why porn is so successful today, because it's correcting for that environmental mismatch.
That's a really interesting way to think about it. Yeah, so when we say that sex is about reproduction, we say that because that is how our species reproduces.
Yeah.
But it is absolutely about connection and pleasure, which is why we have sex with, you know, people who we couldn't possibly reproduce with, and have sex with people for pleasure and connection. But it's that development. What made sex pleasurable and connecting is evolutionary. So the whole social neuroscience system of how we evolved this intense, you know, neural rewards to seek out someone to mate with. Are you familiar with Helen Fisher's work?
You're going to have to remind me the name of the book. But yeah, that name comes up a lot when I talk to people about this stuff.
Yeah. So she's an anthropologist and she's studied thousands of people at various stages of love and puts them in fMRI scanners and works with neuroscientists and has found, you know, different neurochemical combinations at different stages of whether it's attraction, lust, or long-term attachment. But we developed this intense sort of neural reward system so that we would seek out those mating opportunities. And that's what makes them connective. And it's the right. same thing with why women developed or evolved this intense levels of oxytocin after birth and breastfeeding right. so that we would attach to those babies and not leave them. Right. You know, I tell in my human sexuality class, babies are quite annoying. They take all of your resources, right? They make you vulnerable to predators. They're constantly crying. There is absolutely no way any woman in her evolutionarily sound mind would have carried this baby along with her without right. this intense neural reward that you get from right. breastfeeding.
And they make them cute for a reason, right?
And they make them cute for a reason. Exactly. And so yeah, I would still argue that sex is about mating, but we get to enjoy the benefits of the closeness that has evolved because of these neurochemical pathways.
Well, thank you for that lead. So that's exactly how the podcast works. You know, I interview somebody and it's like you've got a compilation album and there's the various artists that make up the compilation album. And then I just follow the different artists to see where that takes me. So
right.
I look forward to reading some more Helen Fisher. Well, tell us about the history of porn. I think this is really interesting that it really did just pop out of nowhere.
So we had the caveman drawings, right?
Right.
And then Greek sculpture and in Asian countries, we have ancient, you know, I mean, there's basically every civilization has had erotica or sexual art, but it was rare that anyone would ever come across it in their lifetime, right? Especially right. as we move more towards like the Renaissance era, all of those sorts of paintings were really commissioned by, you know, royal folks. It would be very rare that commoners such as ourselves would ever come across that type of material in our life, let alone masturbate to it.
Right.
And even with the invention of photography, it was so expensive and, you know, making duplicates and that type of stuff wasn't really possible in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And so people would, of course, take nude photos, but they were mostly for personal use. Or you had to travel to a very large city to look at a peep show. You know, they had those old fashioned, huge metal, basically like a kaleidoscope almost
right.
to watch some woman undressing or what have
right.
you. And then it wasn't until the 40s that we had the invention of the pinup girl that there was this real clear understanding that there was a market for mass distributed sexual imagery and that people will pay a lot of money for this stuff. So we can take pictures of nude women that are sexually suggestive, or we can film people having sex and other people will pay for that. And so then you see Playboy and Hustler come on the scene. Hustler was the first magazine to nationally distribute nude images of the vulva, so the external female genitalia, known as pink shots. So prior to 1974, we did not have national distribution of vulvas and vaginas and penises right. and the like. It was mostly still pretty soft core. But then by the 90s, and you know, certainly earlier than that, but almost every city and town by the 90s had an adult video store. And so even in those times, though, you still had to prove that you were 18 to purchase
right.
anything. So teenagers, you know, we would look in our parents' sock drawers and, you know, find somebody's older brother that had a magazine stash or what have you. But this constant having access to just unlimited porn on your phone or on a device is relatively recent. It's, I think, 2007 was when the first tube site was discovered or recorded which are porn sites that are run, you know, like YouTube.
Right.
And so it's really changed very quickly. And but as they say, pornography drives technology change. So I have, right. you know, social media or media scholar colleagues and such that it's not that the technology change made porn more accessible. It's that, the drive to have porn more accessible created all these new technologies.
Mm-hmm. But certainly, as you pointed out, there's no way that the porn industry could exist if it were not for the technology, right?
Correct. Absolutely.
And do you think there's a gender bias there? So you said the word people, but I think really you're talking about men, aren't you? Because, you know, you talk about Playboy, obviously the audience is men, and then they launched Playgirl and the audience was gay men. Right?
Yeah.
I don't think that women are really turned on by porn in quite the same way as men.
Well, you'd be surprised. So especially now that there's porn that's made for women by women.
And what does that look like?
Yeah, you know, it's it can be very different. The men are much better looking, right? So you have like Ron Jeremy, right? This huge, disgusting old guy was the most popular and successful male porn star. But, you know, women don't want to have sex with somebody like that. But the male market liked him in those films because they were more able to imagine themselves with the girl, the hot girl. If somebody like him, who's hairy with this huge beer belly, could have this, you know, gorgeous blonde 18-year-old, then maybe they could too.
And then so talk about the role of novels for women. So I know that you've written about the very famous book, 50 Shades of Grey. And I wondered if that was the female equivalent of porn, right? So rather than being turned on by images, perhaps they're more turned on by the written word and the narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that women really care more about the context. And when I say women, I mean heterosexual, cisgendered women are really into, you know, why these two people are having sex versus just the sex in and of itself. But women are also really turned on by sounds. So audio porn, there was a study, and I cannot for the life of me remember who did it. I know that it was actually a graduate student at the time. I don't know where she is now, but she did this really innovative study where she had to see if women were aroused by porn the same as men, but she actually let them choose the porn that they were going to watch instead of just given a porn clip. And they were much more aroused because they got to choose something that they found erotic. But for women who didn't like any of the clips, they could also just turn their they reported just turning their laptop around and just listening to it and became aroused. And so, yeah, the imagery does seem to be more arousing for men, gay or straight, and the context or how much these two people really want each other seems to be more exciting for women. But that's not to say that women and, you know, teen girls don't get aroused and seek out porn in all its various varieties, traditional mainstream porn as well.
Right. You're reminding me, actually, Chris Ryan wrote about some interesting studies, and you might have to help me with some of the terminology. But basically, the experiment was they attached some sort of equipment to measure blood flow in the genitalia. And then they also did subjective questioning, and they took a bunch of people. Some of them were straight men, some of them were gay men, and some of them were women. And then they showed these people various different images. And the men, the straight men, were true to form. Like they said they were turned on by something and the blood flow agreed with them. And then the gay men were the same, but the polar opposite, right? 180 degree shift that they're turned on by some two men rather than a man and a woman. And then the women said they were not turned on by anything. And, you know, just as a wild card, they threw into this experiment bonobos having sex. And but when you look at the blood flow, it told a totally different story. It said the women were lying, right? They were turned on by everything, even though subjectively they reported being turned on by nothing.
Exactly. So I was going to bring up that example. Yeah, for women, they don't even have to be human. They just like seeing if there's a connection there, it's hot. So, for example, there's some emerging research that shows that younger women in particular seem to also like watching gay men have sex and bisexual men because there just seems to be more of an honest depiction of pleasure than there can be with the sort of traditional hetero setup.
I've also been thinking a lot about the Coolidge effect. I'm sure you're familiar with the Coolidge effect. It does seem to be a gender bias there as well. That was my question when I read about the Coolidge effect. It's like, well, does it affect women as well as for men? So basically the Coolidge effect is just a preference for novelty, but it seems that men have a greater preference for novelty. And I'm not sure, maybe you can clarify on this, but it seems like it might be protective against incest. So I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're generally not sexually attracted to someone you grew up with. But imagine for a moment you were separated from your sister and then reunited later on, and you were to start having babies with her. Well, that would be disastrous for passing your DNA on to the future. And so some preference for novelty, you might move on to another woman, and that might be protective against incest. But it does seem to affect, I mean, the example that everybody can think of, like, think about Tiger Woods and all the terrible mistakes that he's made, or Arnold Schwarzenegger in his house mistress. Like, what on earth would, you know, this woman have that his wife doesn't? And yet still these men make these terrible mistakes. And I wonder whether this is important for the porn industry, right? Like, so if men love novelty, like, what better way can you think of to deliver novelty than through videos on a website?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I don't know if the Coolidge effect has been studied in women, so I'm not sure that we're able to really definitively make that distinction. But yeah, the Coolidge effect has been found and studied mostly in rats, but there was a study with human men. And yeah, so time to orgasm getting shorter with new mating opportunities. And that, I mean, has been argued from an evolutionary standpoint that because sperm is cheap, the mating strategy would be to have as much sex as possible. Whereas for women, eggs are expensive. You know, we only have one every month, then we have to be more choosy with our partners. But there is also work that shows that, you know, women are sometimes just as likely to cheat as men, particularly when they're ovulating, because it is good for women to get the genes of younger, healthier men, but have the more caring, nurturing man raise the kid and protect her. And so there's a lot of different ways you could look at this, but women crave novelty too. It's just concealed more and hasn't been studied as much.
Yeah, you see, I think this is why you'd enjoy Sex at Dawn, because it's exactly this is like a kind of a post-agriculture worldview that Chris Ryan argues against. So the ancestral condition is that you have free access to all of the men. And then the competition doesn't happen at the level of the organism. So if you think about gorillas, there's only one silverback and he has his harem of women. And so he's duking it out with the other males to get that position. Whereas in humans, there is no such sexual dimorphism, right? And so the competition is happening at the level of the gamete cell, right? Like, you've got access to all of the men, and then the sperm duke it out at that level. And then there's also, I was reading a study just a couple of weeks ago, that the egg might have a preference, or in fact, the whole female immune system might have a preference for particular sperm. And guess what? It may not be the sperm of your partner. Oh, that's interesting. Really? So you're telling me humans are monogamous? Well, that raises an eyebrow, right?
Right. Yeah. And that the hormone immune system point is huge as well that you mentioned. So it's not just the novelty that could prevent against incest, but it's the, you know, how we feel attracted to another person based on their pheromones is a way that we can sort of detect compatibility with our own immune system.
Ah, what do you think about the oral birth control? I think about that a lot as well. That came up in Office Hours. Megan talked about some reasons why maybe you'd want to skip the oral birth control, but this is another good one, right? Is that perhaps when you come off the oral birth control, suddenly you have a preference for a different partner from the one you've been married for a long time, taking oral birth control, you stop taking it. Suddenly you're not into your husband anymore. Like, that's a big problem, right?
Right. So I actually we talk about this in my human sexuality class. And of course, you know, everybody needs to choose the right contraception for them. But we do kind of joke. And I mean, I guess I'm half serious by suggesting that you use either a copper IUD or condoms or both until you meet someone that you want to sort of hang with long term before you go on a hormonal contraception, because you might not be attracted to that person, the same person, if you were taking it upon meeting them.
Talk about the role of some of the stories that you found interesting as a child, like Beauty and the Beast, for example. How do you think those are shaping, especially young women, their expectations of sexuality?
So we have a paper that's under review right now, it will hopefully be coming out soon, fingers crossed, but it's based off a Huffington Post article that I wrote that was kind of popular, but it was seemed to resonate with a lot of folks. But basically, Beauty and the Beast and Twilight and 50 Shades of Grey are all very similar stories where we have this innocent, virginal female character and this aggressive, dangerous, mysterious male character. And it's sort of the female's job to be nice and to comply and to understand that, you know, his outbursts and whatever are out of his control. He doesn't mean them, that type of thing. And so it really sort of can perpetuate this idea that romance is really dependent on danger and drama, breaking up, getting back together, having parents that don't want you together, star-crossed lovers kind of a thing. And which is fine for entertainment's sake. But if that's one of the only narratives that we have in mainstream romantic culture, and if that narrative starts so young, like with something like Beauty and the Beast, then we have a potential problem there because we want people to be aroused and attracted to stories where both partners sort of share power or the power goes back and forth in different ways and where they can really work together as partners and still have it be sexually hot in ways that don't destroy their lives, you know, their individuality or their ambitions or their relationships with their families. But it seems to almost be this cost benefit where the girl needs to choose either her family and her own ambitions or this mysterious man who's who she's obsessed with.
So I think you might agree then that most people don't really want to talk to their kids about sexuality and sex, but they're going to get curious. They are sexual beings and they're going to get their education from somewhere. So you better be careful about where they get it. And you might say the same is true of porn, right? And can you talk about what the worst case scenario is? You know, like if people go into their first sexual experience and they got their education from pornography.
Well, you know, that's one of the arguments that I make all the time is our kids are getting sex education, whether you like it or not. They're getting sexually socialized, whether you like it or not. They're finding out about group sex and anal sex and oral sex, whether you want them to or not. So you can either be in denial and not have those conversations and just hope for the best, or you can sort of get over yourself and do some of your own research and really try to change the way that we raise our kids to be sexual beings. And we don't have definitive research to show whether or not watching a ton of porn before you have sex for the first time is worse than never having seen porn. But we can make some inferences based off of what we do know. And I think one of the big question marks right now, and something that I think about quite a bit, is how are we working to make sure that as humans, we remain connected to each other and that our physical expression of love and intimacy and that sort of magic that sex has can maintain and endure in this space of unlimited access to online sex, right? Because we have scholars, poets, writers of all kinds have written about love since the dawn of time. And, you know, your first sexual experiences can be so profound. I don't know for sure because I haven't done a study on it yet. But from talking with, you know, hundreds of college students in my human sexuality classes, a lot of them have said, like, sex is just boring. Like, I've just seen so much online that it just seems really boring in person. And now I don't know how common that experience is, but it worries me that it's common enough that it comes up in my classes. And I do think it's something we should pay attention to. Maybe not totally freak out about, but really work toward. And we're so far from that because if we can't even have sex education that talks to young people, where we're talking to young people about contraception and health, how in the hell are we going to have sex education where we're talking to them about pleasure and connection? Right. And I'm not talking about monogamous exclusivity type of intimacy and connection. That is a choice that people can make if they want to. we talk a lot about in my classes and in our lab about how you can have really connecting, respectful, intimate sex with somebody that you just met.
Right.
But that emphasis on the connection and the respect and the being in the moment, how do we teach that in a world where you can just be on your phone the whole day?
Right. You know, you've just given me an idea for a randomized control trial that you could write the grant proposal for this weekend.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, you just get a bunch of 17-year-olds and then you randomize them, maybe even younger, actually. And, you can't go much younger, can you? 16 is the youngest, I suppose. And then you randomize into two groups. One gets the porn, the other one doesn't. And then you can just count the number of horrific behaviors that happen in the first sexual encounter. And,
exactly.
And then get that published.
Exactly, right? Oh, brilliant. I'm going to write it up this weekend. I'm sure all the ethics boards will be check. Sure. Sure. Go ahead, Dr. Moz. Let's randomly assign a bunch of minors to porn viewing. No, but honestly, that is the kind of the study that we wish we all could have, is that randomized, because the only thing that we can say right now is teens who use porn have these differences from teens who don't. Or teens right. who use more porn have these differences from teens who use less. But are the porn users, do they have higher sex drives? Do they masturbate right. more? Are they just more sensation-seeking in general? And so that's why they might have more sexual partners or an earlier sexual debut or less likely to use condoms or contraception? Or is it because, you know, porn has taught them to be that way? We really don't know for sure.
Right. And you're reminding me, this is an interesting way to think about this. And this is true for the older men as well as younger and women too, I suppose. But is this getting you what you want, right? Like, is this an away move or a towards move? It's not whether pornography is good or bad. It's like, is it helping you get what you want? Like, so if your goal is to have more intimacy and a better sexual relationship with your partner, does pornography help you do that? Or does it not help you do that? Like, it's probably a pretty easy answer to question to answer. And I think in most cases, the answer is no, right? Like if you're used to seeing crazy stuff on the internet, then real life, as you said, is like kind of dull by comparison.
So it's interesting. So there's a gender disparity that seems to be very consistent in the literature among adults in, you know, using porn in relationships or in marriage. And actually for women who use porn, they are higher in sexual satisfaction and higher in desire, and they're more likely to have sex with their partner. Whereas men, heterosexual men who use more porn in a married situation are lower in sexual satisfaction and it's associated with more problems. So it really depends on the person. Now, sometimes these types of associations are not there in terms of pornography use, but it could be more like the motivation for use, like what you're saying.
Right.
Are you using it to escape and avoid a partner, or are you using it for entertainment sometimes? Is it just to facilitate masturbation here or there? Or is it something that's really kind of taken over your world and your thought process? Mm-hmm. I'm so excited that you talk about that question, because that's something that we talk about in my class, is let's stop with the, is porn good or bad?
Right.
But let's get conscious about what the role it's playing in your life. And
right.
how do you know what role it's playing in your life?
Right.
Well, you have to kind of get nitty gritty and introspective about it. Maybe you give it up for a short period of time. I'm not at all suggesting that or advocating that people quit porn for life, even though some people do that, and there's nothing wrong with that either. But really being conscious about what it's doing. Is it helping you form sexual relationships and have great sex? Or are you using it sort of as a substitute for sex and it's making
right.
you maybe more lonely? These are important questions to be able to answer. And I think it's different for different people. You know, there's different mm-hmm. typologies of porn use and porn motivations and that type mm-hmm. type of thing. I was going to say, but one of the things I do say is nobody becomes great at sex just by watching sex. Just
right,
like
right.
nobody becomes a great basketball player from watching,
right.
you know, the NBA or what have you. It's
right.
It doesn't work that way.
Right. Although it could be useful to look at that. Like once you get good, like sometimes it's helpful to read the manual after you try doing it. Right.
Right.
Maybe pornography is rarely a manual that you'd want to read, but
right.
Yeah, I wouldn't want the listeners to think that I had an original idea there. Of course, I got this from our performance psychologist, Simon Marshall, and he didn't even come up with that idea. It's from acceptance and commitment therapy. And Russ Harris has written some fantastic books that we've mentioned many times on the podcast before. Could you talk a bit about the morality and the ethics of the porn industry? Is this something that any of us would want to support financially?
So that is an excellent question, because now that the majority of porn is free, it's being paid for in other ways. And so we really have to be conscious about where our porn comes from, sort of in the same way that we would want to be conscious about where our food comes from. Who is making the money? How is it being made? You know, how are the performers being treated? And unfortunately, with the ease of this new technology of tube sites, you know, that are run by YouTube, anyone can upload any video they want. So for example, Pornhub right now is sort of under fire because there are advocates who are working to expose videos of minors that have been, you know, posted, of course, non-consensually. And Pornhub, you know, states that they have moderators for age verification. But they also say that they don't do age verification in terms of asking how would you possibly contact all of these people that are... So there's a huge issue with free porn in that regard. I mean, in order to really understand ethical porn, there's only a handful of companies who really create ethical porn, where everybody is a consenting adult. Nobody is coerced either through financial desperation or coercion or drugs or alcohol, and where the performers are paid well as perhaps even making some of the profits if those videos were to become, you know, quote unquote, virally popular. And so it's really important to know where your porn is coming from, and then to also make sure that you aren't supporting, you know, the demand for those more abusive type videos or of showcasing younger girls, for instance, or trafficked individuals. So there's a fine line between, you know, just choosing good old fashioned adult fun and really contributing to a demand for on-screen, you know, sexual abuse. It is such a tricky topic because it's such an important one. You don't want to ignore it. And I think among pornography researchers, sex researchers, and, you know, advocates for ending sexual violence against women and children, there's a lot of backfire because one group kind of wants to say that all porn is good, that's consenting adults, everybody needs to stop being an alarmist. And another group might say that all porn is bad because it's driving any kind of demand for anything for sex with, you know, younger people or younger women and girls in particular. So it's such an important conversation, I think, to keep having. But that's where my perspective comes in, is that's another piece of the consciousness, being conscious about your pornography use. How is it affecting your life? Is it helping you get what you want? But also, how is your porn viewing affecting other people's lives? So is the content that you're choosing, who's making the money? So find out more about that corporation. So for example, MindGeek, they own the top 5 porn tube sites. So maybe do some little investigation into them and how they run their businesses. And is that something that you want to support? Because when you visit those websites, they get more traffic, which means more ad revenue. And so you're supporting them even if you aren't paying for it.
Okay, so that was going to be my next question. Right. If that is how they make their money, it's through ads.
Yes. It's becoming less taboo for companies to advertise on, say, like Pornhub, which is crazy because porn, I mean, there have been dozens, if not hundreds of videos found of girls and boys under 18, and yet advertisers are still willing to advertise on those sites.
Right. And you're reminding me of something that might be important here, and that's that, you know, so most online advertising has gone to Facebook and Google, but if Google is not willing to run ads for porn or guns or anything else they don't seem to be aligned with, then that creates a huge opportunity for somebody else to come along and say, hey, we'll run your ad.
Totally. Absolutely. There's that market piece too. So it's not just, I think one of the things that I love about doing porn research is that there's so many different levels you can understand this. I mean, you can understand it at the neurological level. What's this doing to your brain? You can understand it at the personal level. What's this doing for your own self-concept and your attitudes about the world? The interpersonal level. What's it doing for your relationship with others? You know, the societal level, the economic level. What is it doing to our marketplace? And historically, of course. So there's just so many ways to think about it. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, let's talk about what it's doing to your brain for kids then. I think you made a fantastic analogy in your TED Talk. I'm going to link to everything that Megan and I mentioned in this podcast in the show notes for this episode that you can find by poking around inside of your podcast app or coming to nourishbalancethrive.com/podcast. But you made this analogy, which I thought was fantastic, where you compared pornography to fast food, right? It's like, have we engineered it just a little bit too good? And so the question is, do you want your kids learning about nutrition from the fast food companies, or do you want to teach them, right? Like, and the same is true here. Like, do you want to teach them about sexuality, or do you want the porn industry to do it? Like, I think it makes me feel uncomfortable, but I think I'm going to have to do it.
Right. I know. And I don't mean to be like a total alarmist that, you know, all kids are going to be, are doomed because of internet porn. But I think it is something to be alarmed about that we have this internet porn in the absence of comprehensive sex education in schools and parental discussions about bodies and sex throughout from birth to age 18 or beyond. And so if the only source of sex education is coming from porn and media, because we also know that in schools, at least in America, sex education is brief, it can be very boring. Kids don't pay attention to it. Oftentimes they'll opt out.
It comes a year after everybody started having sex.
Yeah, exactly. It comes after everybody's had sex. So, I mean, we need a major transformation of sex education in the US and in other places around the world. But yeah, I like the fast food analogy just because I think humans, particularly young people, it can help them think about things differently when we use analogies. It's not a perfect analogy, but yeah, it's kind of like, porn is kind of like the fast food of sex. It's not something that you would want to use for all of your sexual needs, right? It's more of an occasional type of thing, and understanding that it is the fast and easy version of sex versus, you know, other types of sex that are rewarding in other ways, but might not be as convenient.
Right. You know, another mental model that your work reminds me of, I bet you've read this book, The Carpenter, or maybe you don't because you're a scientist and you read the original literature, but are you familiar with Alison Gopnik?
Oh, that name sounds so familiar.
Yeah, the book is The Carpenter and the Gardener.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's a really fantastic metaphor that raising kids is like tending a garden, you know, like you kind of just have to keep the weeds out when you never know what you're going to get. And it's a lot less like carpentry where you measure twice and cut once. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot about when I'm going to intervene as a, you know, a stronger and older and wiser person. And the answer generally is as little as possible, right? But a rule I have is no permanent disfigurement. So if I see somebody that's about to get mortally injured, then I will step in. And I think maybe the porn thing, like maybe is like one of the weeds that Alison Gopnik wrote about in her book. And perhaps there is the potential for permanent disfigurement. And so perhaps this is a place where I should step in.
Well, yeah, I think so. The advice I give parents, and this is just based off of research, talking with parents, my own kind of observations, it's not in any means a prescription for the perfect life. But I think the first thing that parents need to be aware of is that their kid is going to see porn and a lot of it before they turn 18. Where they see the porn, I think, is important. So they're watching it on their friend's phone in the back of the bus. They're catching glimpse here and there, you know, at a friend's house, or even while they hear you upstairs before you come downstairs, kind of a thing. That's very different than having unlimited private time in their room with their laptop or phone. We talk different about the typologies. The kid that's allowed to just watch hours of porn is never really checked in upon, or could be getting, for girls in particular, receiving all sorts of sexual solicitations from strangers on Instagram and such. You kind of want to limit that private time that they have with their phone and their laptop. And that can be limiting sort of the space that they have access to, because it's going to be difficult to develop a porn problem, for lack of a better term, or it's going to be difficult to experience problems from porn if you're not just allowed to submerge yourself in it every day, right? If you're going to have to be doing things differently with your time, it's going to be hard for that to totally derail a teen. But yeah, you hear these stories. I mean, I did a training once and somebody said that they discovered that their 9-year-old had been watching just tons of porn on their Kindle Fire. They didn't know that they could access that, you know, in their bedroom alone, because they figured out how to Google the word boobs and then went from there.
Wow. I'm impressed by the...
I know, right? So at one hand, you're like, okay, well, that was some impressive research. But on the other hand, you know, limiting that. And that's good for all of us. None of us should be on our devices alone in our room for hours.
Right.
No matter how old you are, no matter what you're doing on a device, like, we want to limit that time so that we're using our devices to help us and not having them, you know, take over our world.
Right. And you're reminding me of my interview I did with Cal Newport on digital minimalism. And he talked about this. Maybe we should be modeling that behavior, right? And he made the case against keeping devices in bedrooms. In fact, it was my colleague Tammy pointed out that her son's bedroom looked like a studio apartment, right? It's got like everything you need. Whereas, you know, Ashley Mason, a clinical psychologist I interviewed, she made the case for stimulus control, right? Like, what are you doing in this environment? Like, if you want to sleep in there, then you probably don't want your TV and all this other stuff in there anyway. And Cal Newport came up with this idea of the, you know, like the phone booth. You remember those old school kiosks?
Oh, yeah.
You know, and if you want to use your phone, then you go to the kiosk and you use your phone, you leave it there. You pretend that it's tethered to that space so that you're not just wandering around with this device connected to you 24/7. But I'm sure you'd agree that modeling that behavior for younger people is going to be important, because actually that's part of what Alison Gopnik wrote about as well. It's that it's not the things that you do tell to the kids and do to the kids. It's all the subconscious things that make up 99% of their, what shapes their environment, that's important. And so modeling the behavior is very important.
And it's so hard to do. Oh, especially in this quarantined life.
Yeah, of course. Of course.
I'm constantly having to remind myself, like, okay, when are we putting away the phones? When are we taking breaks? When are we, you know, because if you don't have, in my experience, and this is just personal experience as well as talking with others, I'm not sure what the research is on it, but I feel like if you don't have scheduled time where there is no tech,
right,
then it's going to be hard to do, rather scheduling time for tech. So for example, saying like, I'm only going to check email at this time and this time, or this time, or only going to be on social these times, or I'm only going to be watching TV these times, it can be really easy to slide that around versus like, we don't have any screens from 5:30 to 8. There's just nothing. Right. We only answer the phone if it's a relative who needs something or whatever. But we're not doing any email or social or whatever for this chunk of time.
You're right, though. It's really hard when your office and your living room is the same place.
Oh, gosh. Then yeah. Yeah.
It's very difficult to make that separation, especially as a small business owner. No, if you're running your own gig, then time is money and you just have much more skin in the game and you're just...
Totally.
Just one more opening of the laptop, I'd be done in just a minute.
I know. And it's hard when, especially when you love your work too.
Of course.
It's hard to shut
So when's the earliest, when should people be thinking about talking to kids about porn?
Yeah. So in an ideal world, you would have already been talking to them about bodies. So correct terminology for genitalia. Girls should know about vulvas and vaginas and that that's what they have, and that boy bodies have penises and scrotum, and just kind of get them comfortable with that term. The other thing that you can do with little ones, and it's worked really well with my girls, and I have some books on my website that I recommend, is, you know, they want to know about where babies come from and how babies live in a mom's belly, and teaching them about the uterus and how that works and everything can help just lay a foundation that these things that other people are not comfortable talking about are things that my mom and dad are comfortable talking about, so that they aren't freaked out. Because if you're in a situation where your kid knows that you're going to cringe and turn beet red, just the notion of the word, you know, they're like, there's no way in hell I'm going to mom or dad about this. Like, they freak out. They can't even say the word penis or vagina. So there's a lot of foundational work that I think should be done. There are people who write children's books about porn and what it is. It's hard to give those analogies to young folks. There's a book called Good Pictures, Bad Pictures. There's a book that explains why your body gets aroused when you see these types of things. But I think kids, as soon as they're like kind of on their devices and much younger now, especially in quarantine with online school, it's okay to tell them that there are pictures and video of naked people and people doing things. If you haven't explained what sex is yet, it might be a good idea to explain it. I know people freak out, but you can explain sex in ways that are vague. And if they ask for more questions, you can answer them, but you don't have to like tell them everything about different types of penetration and ejaculation. Like you can describe it in different ways. But I think what's key in explaining to young children, if they come across video or nude images, to get an adult, because that's something that means that something's gone wrong with their device. So for the little ones, I'm talking like 7 to 11, that means that something is wrong and you should get an adult. But how your body reacts to that isn't wrong. Explain to them that our bodies can have all sorts of feelings when we see videos and images like that. And sometimes the feelings feel kind of good. Sometimes they feel kind of scary, but they usually feel kind of intense and you might feel embarrassed and you don't know why, but it's okay to get an adult. Right. And then for 11 to 14, 15 year olds, just straight up talking about what porn is. And I have a little mini ebook guide on my website that kind of goes into this in more detail, but explaining to them that this is sex turned into a product. It's not necessarily sex you would have with someone you have a crush on or, you know, someone you're in a relationship with. And also explaining that body piece. Your body has evolved to react to this. And that's okay. That's what's supposed to happen. And that's what makes it embarrassing. But, you know, it doesn't freak me out to know that you've seen it. It doesn't freak me out to know that it's out there. But I do want to help you and make sure that you have the ability to develop really satisfying sexual relationships and experiences. And what we do know is that the porn that you have access to now is not necessarily going to help you perhaps achieve that right now, because this is something that's for adults. And then after 15, you can have these questions, but they're going to seek it out. If they want to, they're going to find a way to do it. You just need to be able to communicate your expectations and just be able to communicate that you aren't dumb. Like, you know, this is out there and you know that they can find it if they want to. And they know that it might be really arousing and something you want to use to masturbate with. But maybe that's where the fast food analogy comes in. Like, you want to be conscious about how you're using this type of thing and learn how to masturbate the old fashioned way. Will serve you well as you age. You don't want to get too, you want to be diverse in what and how you find sexual pleasure. So there's these developmentally different ways you'd have those kinds of conversations. But when they're young, explaining that this just means you need to come get an adult. And that's why I also tell parents, even though the technology is changing constantly and there's so many different options to choose from, but having various different parental controls on devices is really important for younger folks, because usually the 8 to 13 year olds are stumbling on porn unintentionally because they heard boobs in their or butt and they want to Google that, or they hear the word blowjob and they want to Google that. They're not necessarily like, I'm going to go watch me some porn and masturbate. Like, that's not their intention, right?
Right.
And so those kinds of things can be good to just sort of make sure that the younger kids are less likely to stumble upon it, whereas older kids know how to get around those technologies.
As always, my wife's about a million years ahead of me on all this stuff. And I hear these terms like body positivity and sex positivity. And I suppose that's what it is, that she's never had a problem being I mean, we both now, I mean, I was kind of a prude when we met, but she's never had a problem being naked around the kids, even though, you know, our daughter's now six, and she's never had a problem answering any of their questions using the correct medical terms as you just described. And then I think particularly for our daughter, who's now six, like talking about the menstrual cycle is important. So it's not this terrible, scary thing. Like, what the hell? I'm bleeding to death, you know?
Right.
And I'm wondering whether we might just eliminate that phase. You know, I can't imagine that my son is ever going to think at the age like 13, what are boobs? And like Googling them. He seemed like he's been around boobs. Like, that's not that much of a deal, right? And I wonder,
right.
You know, I think a lot about, you know, it's almost like a tectonic plate movement. You know, like if you, the reason earthquakes are a problem is because that pressure built up over a very long period of time and then is suddenly released. And that's what causes the devastation. And I wonder whether, you know, just, you know, slow, gradually, incrementally, like would be a better way to release the pressure. And maybe the same is true here. If you start them young and just like very slowly, incrementally introduce them to these ideas rather than waiting until they're 15 and then doing the beat red thing that you described earlier.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you want to have lots of little teeny tiny conversations. Like the talk should not happen because talk is traumatic for everyone involved. It's embarrassing. And you know, the other thing that's cool too, my oldest, she's 7, almost 8. This is just such a great age because they're like little scientists. Nothing freaks them out. They want to know about everything. There might be little giggles here and there. But for my daughter, who's had probably similar to yours, you know, these open conversations her whole life. So, but she's noticed now, you know, like other kids don't know this stuff or they laugh when they see somebody's underwear. And so she's noticing. And so we're kind of trying to talk about social norms. Like, yeah, we have these funny sort of ideas in our society. And so people think that this stuff is embarrassing. And so they might not be as open and that type of thing. But I think, yeah, anything that sort of demystifies sex, it's got to make porn less powerful. So one of the things that's interesting in the research that shows that for folks who are higher in religiosity, particularly higher in sort of Christian religiosity, where they, you know, go to attend church more, identify more, they actually tend to use, and in states where there are more evangelicals, they actually tend to use more porn than folks who, yeah, are more agnostic or atheist. And one of the sort of hypotheses around that is that because sex is just really swept under the rug, really an elephant in the room, the porn just becomes so mysterious and intriguing. And if it's so taboo and wrong, it almost creates more of an attraction to
it. Right. You're reminding me, Alison Gopnik has another book called The Scientist in the Crib. And I haven't read that book, but it's what you just said. It's that babies are born as scientists should be, right? They come up with a hypothesis about the world and then they try and disprove it. They don't try to prove it. They try to disprove it.
Right.
And that's how they form their worldview. That's how they figure out that, you know, hard objects are hard and things fall down, not up when they roll off the edge of the table. Right.
But that's where this distinction, I think, is also not being made in mass media or at home, is that there's a difference between telling young people you shouldn't be looking at porn, this is dirty and wrong and awful, versus talking about, hey, we don't know how this is going to affect your arousal, your like ability to have orgasms. We don't know how, you know, you going on this site all the time is supporting potentially the abuse of girls and women someplace else. Like there are some real concerns to think about, but the concern shouldn't be because porn is dirty or wrong, or you are dirty and wrong for wanting to look at it, or masturbation is disgusting and wrong. Like those are different concerns. And I think whenever scientists raise a concern about how is this connected to coercion and abuse of women and girls, or how might this impact sexual satisfaction, you know, in relationships, it can sort of automatically be construed into this, oh, you're supporting moral panic, you're being too conservative and an alarmist, like evangelical anti-porn folks. So I think it's important to really make that distinction. Like there's a difference between being wanting to be conscious about porn and what you're using, how it's impacting the world and how it's impacting you, versus you're just anti-porn or pro-porn. Like, it's just so much more complicated than that. And I think we can have that conversation with young people. We can really distinguish the fact, like, yeah, it's fun to be aroused. It's fun to watch people have sex. It is arousing. We like to do those kinds of things. But it's complicated because it's an industry. And now because you can access it all the time versus before, when we had all these barriers to porn users in the 70s, 80s, and even 90s, it was just a few times a year. Now the porn users and studies are like multiple times a week. And so the frequency in which we use porn has changed over time. Mm-hmm. And so we've never had adolescents that have had this kind of access to porn before.
Right.
And so we just don't know how it might impact them. So getting them to actually think about how that might impact them is different than getting them to be afraid of porn because it's wrong and bad. Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
I do. I think you raised an important point, which is we're not seeing the results. There's not rapid feedback. You know, when I tell my kid, in fact, I don't even need to tell my kid to get their hand out of the hot flame, right? They find out right away it's hot and they take it out and the pain stops. Whereas with talking to them about pornography, you may never see the results, right? Like, maybe some young man doesn't do something weird in his first sexual experience because of the conversation you have, but you're not going to be there when that does or doesn't happen.
Right, exactly. And you're not going to be there when he and his partner have to go to couples counseling because their sex life is not what they want it to be and their marriage is or a relationship is not what they want it to be, but none of them know how to talk about it because they're used to just watching porn and masturbating or having sex and mimicking what they see in porn. They're not used to talking about it, right? Because porn doesn't showcase sexual communication necessarily. There's been some studies that have tried to code how communication goes down, but typically what they find in porn is that you move from one thing to the next without talking about it. So, you know, people don't know how to communicate sexually. So there's just a lot of stuff to learn and to think about. And porn should just be one piece of this huge repertoire of sexual knowledge and experiences that one has. And I fear that we're kind of short, especially young people can be very short-sighted because porn is so easy to access. It's so arousing that they're not thinking about sex in other ways or even allowing them the space to think about it in other ways.
Well, I think this would be a good place to wrap up and point people at your fantastic resource, How to Talk to Kids About Porn. I'll link to that in the show notes. But just one final question. Am I right in thinking it's absolutely essential that I must install some sort of filter on my internet router? I can't get away with not doing that.
I think for young ones, yeah, you might as well. If you want to make sure that you're doing what you can so that they don't stumble upon, because, you know, it's not like if the potential to stumble upon a naked person or people having loving, connecting sex, great. But it's the potential to stumble upon sexual abuse material and kind of more violent, aggressive stuff that we wouldn't want anybody to have, young people to have this kind of access to. So I think you should. I think it couldn't hurt.
Right. And what do you think, you know, I listened to the Sam Harris podcast, The Worst Epidemic, that was truly horrifying. I can't recommend it in terms of entertainment.
Oh, but gosh, yeah.
I think it was very good in terms of its ability to educate. And it's a podcast about child sex abuse. And one of the things that really struck me was this idea that there could be people hanging out on social media, pretending to be younger than they really are, asking young people to take pictures of themselves. And then once they've got the picture, they then use it as a form of extortion, sometimes to get that kid to abuse a younger sibling to get more pictures like that, which I thought was utterly terrifying. And I hadn't even considered that before.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is for a few years, I tried to work in this child pornography, but that's misleading because it's not adult entertainment. It's video footage of, you know, and they get at the Sam Harris podcast gets at this. It's video footage of a sexual abuse crime. So sexual abuse material. When I first learned about, particularly in countries, really poor developing countries, like in Indonesia, for example, it's a huge problem there because you can make quite a bit of money abusing girls on webcams. And then people in the UK and in the US and Australia, presumably white, heterosexual, older men will use, you know, like Bitcoin or something to pay for that to happen so they can watch it live on webcams. I mean, utterly horrific. I can't think of anything worse. It's not just sexual abuse. It is sexual abuse for entertainment. And it is people using sexual abuse for pleasure. And honestly, I just could not, I stopped talking about it in lectures. I don't even talk about it in my human sexuality course anymore because it's so difficult to talk about something that deserves so much attention and so many resources, and to then go, okay, now we're moving on to orgasms and condoms.
I think Sam Harris discusses that problem in the podcast. It's like nobody wants to do it, right? The laws are in place, the budget is in place. It's just, who wants to do that for a living, right?
It's terrifying. And I actually went into a pretty deep depression for about 6 months or so after I started learning about that. And then I just thought, okay, this is where I draw the line in my own work. I don't research that. And I support everyone who does and works towards ending that. But this is not where I can spend my time and energy. But it is important, I think, from a prevention standpoint to understand, you know, there was this huge investigation that came out, I think it was just a year ago, where they had a whole bunch of folks go undercover on Instagram and pretend like they're 11-year-old girls. And they would get the same sort of script from these older perpetrators who would say, do you know what a penis is? Do you know what a boyfriend is? And then they would show them a picture of the penis. You know, can you show me a picture of your, when good girlfriends will put their mouths on their boyfriend's penis and that's how they show love. Is that something you would do for me? Do you have anybody there who you could do that for? Like almost the exact same process with all of these different plants pretending to be 11 on Instagram.
Right.
And so we have to kind of be aware that, and if your kid doesn't have the previous knowledge to know, hey, there's these total monsters out there, and they don't have the language to be like, oh, no, I know what that's about, and delete, block, I'm done with you, then they can get really sucked into that. Particularly some of the work that I've done, my dissertation work was looking at girls who were more vulnerable to online sexual experiences. And they are girls who have experienced more maltreatment or neglect in their life or abuse themselves, because then it becomes all the more alluring and arousing because they have somebody who's paying attention to them. And so one of the things I kind of talk about is making sure that your kids, particularly girls, are involved in lots of things that give them sources of confidence and attention, and really are focused on things that have nothing to do with what they look like, but have to do with who they are as a person, what they might do in the future, just so that they're not vulnerable to people telling, you know, strangers telling them that they're beautiful online, so that they can be like, oh, nope, I know what that is. Instead of like, wow, this person thinks I'm beautiful. I'm going to keep talking to him. You don't want that kind of vulnerability.
Like if, you know, a child's love should be unconditional, right? Like, and I think, again, it's the technology, isn't it? I think Sam does a really good job discussing the role of technology in that podcast, and particularly the role of cryptography. Like the Zoom connection that we're using to record this call is fully encrypted. Like not even the FBI can get into this unless the FBI happens to be on the call, which has happened, and people have gone to jail for that. But do we really need strong cryptography for us to talk about mundane business things on Monday morning with our colleagues? I'm not sure we do. And you might say the same is true of Facebook Messenger. Facebook have been doing, it would appear, a really good job of reporting all this stuff, but they're about to encrypt Messenger, like WhatsApp is encrypted. And so how are you going to scan this stuff when it's all end-to-end encrypted? I don't know.
I know. It has changed a lot, right? I mean, you can't deny that it hasn't. I mean, there's lots of folks that worry that any discussion of this is going to increase moral panic around the issue. But honestly, you had to exchange nude images of children being sexually abused that are Polaroids in a parking lot. That's way harder than just live streaming and downloading. Like in the podcast, they said the number of material that is turned over in terms of the number of videos, the number of photos has just skyrocketed in frequency. Not the number of reports, but the amount of videos that are turned over to the FBI. So it is unfortunately something that we have to be aware of, but we also have to not act from a place of fear. Yeah, I know that some parents and some folks will think like, well, gosh, if all you're talking about is that my kid is going to get sexually solicited online to have sex with some man offline, or my son is going to be watching all this porn and become addicted to it. Like, no, those are some things to think about. But
right,
having these consistent conversations with them about their bodies, about sex, about consent, about online safety, all of that can ensure that these things don't happen to your kid, because the majority of kids, these things don't happen to.
Right, right.
The majority of kids are going to be online a lot. They're going to be exposed to all sorts of stuff on social media and porn, and they're going to be fine. They're going to be just fine. But there are a subset of kids that are not, and we need to work as a society to make sure that they get what they need to be protected.
Well, I think your Talking to Kids guide is a fantastic place for people to start. So
thank you.
I will, of course, link to that guide. Is there anywhere else that you would send people to follow and learn more about your work?
Just my website, meganmaz.com. There's resources on there. I have some blog posts and some educational videos, and you can sort of learn more about me. And I'm happy to talk with anyone who wants to email directly. I answer questions and things like that sometimes. But yeah, I just encourage you to have those conversations and practice talking about this kind of thing with friends and a partner, a spouse, before you talk about it with kids, to get sort of your own giggles and blush out. But
what are you talking about? It's always,
I know, right? But yeah,
what else are you gonna talk about,
right? I know.
The weather.
I know, right? So we can all do it. It's all gonna be good, and our kids deserve it. Just think of all the things that you wish you had growing up in terms of support about your own bodies and your own sexual experiences. We can give that to the next generation.
You remind me so many things. Isn't it like the worst thing about being a parent is it forces you to relive all your childhood experiences? Yeah. And then you try to reject all the things that you didn't like about it and maybe cherry pick some of the things you did. And it's just like a constant torture.
Right. We're just trying to kick the ball a little bit further down the field. And exactly. And luckily, we do have models that show, you know, like Northern European models. I know people love to make those comparisons. They don't necessarily apply globally because they're different societies. But the lifespan approach of talking about bodies, consent, love, pleasure in developmentally appropriate ways, where you talk about bodies and boundaries to kindergarten, and then by the time, you know, they're in middle school, they already have a ton of vocabulary about what is romantic love versus familiar love. What's a crush? How do you know that somebody's enjoying playing a game together? You can use those same skills to see if somebody's enjoying having sex with you, or if you need to check in with somebody, you know, and understand they have the language of this over time. So they tend to have lower instances of sexual violence and unwanted pregnancy, particularly among teens. And that's because they have this life approach, that this is like a life education that deserves as much attention as history class or music class.
Well, I think that's a fantastic place to wrap up. Megan, thank you so much. You've been very generous with your time. And I'm very grateful for my education. You know, sometimes people ask me, what is this podcast? Are you just soapboxing? And the answer is no, you're just listening to a recording of my education. You know? Well, so I'm just like, when I interviewed Peter Gray, he talked about the importance of age mixing. You know, the older kids are like the scaffolding that help the younger kids up. And so that's just me. I'm just an older kid, you know, like I just received my education slightly before you. That's it.
Well, I appreciate it. And I am such a huge fan of podcasts. And this is a great way to learn, right?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
It's a great way to learn.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me on.